go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. We're back once again. My name is Ben. I write some videos here.
And I'm Scott Benjamin. I'm the auto editor here at HowStuffWorks.com. And, Ben, we got a pretty interesting topic, I think, today.
I think so, too.
I think the fans are going to like this one because it's a racing topic. And judging by past experience, seems like everybody really enjoys the racing topics that we do.
Yeah, we do have some race fans. And yeah. I mean, the name of the show is High Speed Stuff.
Yeah, we try when we can to keep it high speed, but usually it's, planes, trains, automobiles, that type of thing.
So we have some guest stars today, at least in terms of listener mail, right?
We do, yeah. We've got same topic, three suggestions, three requests, I should say. One was kind of, one of these three is indirect. I'll explain that in a minute as I get to it. But the first one came in just recently. And it was, let's see, from Ryan from England. And Ryan from England says that he thinks drag racing would be a great subject to cover. So maybe something about the history of drag racing, different types of dragsters, etc. So drag racing was his suggestion. The second one that we have here, and this is the indirect request.
Okay.
And I'll explain it in a minute, but it does have something to do with drag racing. Eric from Boise, Idaho. He's 23. He's a certified gearhead, he says. He says he wanted to... This isn't exactly where we're going, but he wants to know about explaining some of the ways that ordinary people can go racing. And
he mentioned
it in here, and I think we're going to hang on to this one as another separate topic, something we can do later in depth. Because he mentioned a lot of different types of racing, rally racing, high-performance driving schools, autocross, that type of racing. But he also mentioned drag racing because there's a lot of open track days. So indirectly, Eric from Boise, Idaho has also mentioned drag racing. And let's see, the last one then, Ted from St. Louis, Missouri. And I remember Ted's city and state from another email. He didn't tell us on this one, but says that he loves the show, makes his workday go a lot faster, and he thinks he's listened to all of them in the last 2 months. So I think he just downloaded every one of them and is done listening to them straight through.
Awesome. Still not sick of us, Ted? That's great.
After 2 months, a solid month.
Go on.
But he says, I wonder if you consider doing a show on top fuel dragsters. And top fuel dragsters, he wants to know specifically their stats, horsepower, speed, what makes them so amazing, I guess, because he mentions that the 0 to 60 times are incredible, and but really we'll find out that 0 to 60 feet that they measure. Teardowns, rebuilds, fuel lines, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So Ted, from St. Louis, Missouri, this one is for you, and also for Ryan, and was it Eric? Flipping through my notes. Eric, yeah.
Yep. So, okay, when we start off about this, since we are going to check out top fuel dragsters, just real quick, a little elevator speech about the National Hot Rod Association.
Fantastic.
Okay, so started by Wally Parks because... he wanted people to have a legal, legitimate venue and an environment in which to race.
Mm. Very important.
Yeah, nothing will throw a 1950s era race off like the police showing up.
Yeah, that's right. Even a 2010 era race, really.
Yeah, sure.
I guess goes without saying. It's safest on the track, right?
Yeah. So he founded it in 1951. It's pretty much second only to NASCAR, so this is one of the big dogs, right? There are, 80,000 members or so in the NHRA.
Wow.
Yeah, and you can log on there and become a member yourself.
So that's, you're saying in all of NHRA, not just the pro drivers, of course. That's
not just the pro
drivers. They're kind of like an elite little group of racers in a certain category, right? But how many, 80,000?
Yeah, and that's membership to the NHRA.
Oh, so you and I could go on the NHRA site and join. Okay, got it.
We don't have to have a top fuel dragster.
But I wish I did.
Oh, God, I wish you did too, man.
Yeah, I wish you did too. I mean,
I wish we had four.
I wish you had one, and then you'd have the cost associated with one, but I'd still get to ride in it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man.
Oh, perfect. That works out well for me then. Good.
Okay, well, we have a plan.
All right.
What do you think? We should talk about what exactly is a top fuel dragster and how it's different.
Well, top fuel dragster, we're going to talk specifically about the great big long dragsters.
Mm-hmm.
There's other top fuel dragsters that are there's a class that's the funny car class. And we're not really talking about that class. That's the type with the single piece body that lifts up in the front. The funny cars are the ones that, you know, single plastic body or carbon fiber, whatever they happen to be now. They lift up. You see the engine, the driver underneath. That's a different type of car. They're just about as fast as the top fuel dragsters. But I'm talking about the long, you know, 25-foot-long rail cars that you're thinking of, with the giant wheels in the rear end, the huge foil on the top. That's what we're talking about today. So you've probably seen these, right?
Yeah, and the driver sits in the middle of the vehicle as far as, like, you know, he doesn't sit on the left or the right.
Exactly.
He's in the center.
In the center with the engine behind him or her.
Yeah.
And the front end is exceptionally long. Gets really narrow at the front. They have those tiny little tires
at the
front.
Tiny tires, yeah.
Yeah, and the back end are those, you know, super wide and tall slicks that they become deformed as the car accelerates.
And we have to get into those later.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. Do you want to get into them now?
If you want, go ahead, because we're just going to kind of jump all over the place in this one, because there's a lot of really cool facts and figures associated with top fuel dragsters, and I think it's just going to be one of these where we just kind of mention something and take it from there.
Okay, I really did kind of jump into tires because what I want to talk about really is the burnout.
Oh, yeah.
Can we talk about the burnout?
Oh, yeah, I love the burnout.
Okay. When I say we, I mean, can you talk about the burnout?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I guess the purpose of the burnout, you've probably seen this. They get to the line, they burn the tires, a lot of smoke. They only go, I don't know, 100 feet down the track maybe, and then they back up and come back for the start again. The reason that they're doing that, they're kind of choosing a line where they're going to start. They burn the tires. They lay down, and not only does it heat up the tires that they're using, makes them softer and better grip, it also lays down a thin coating of rubber for the now sticky tire to adhere to. So now you've laid down fresh new rubber for your now sticky tire to grab onto, so you can have the best acceleration possible. So it's strategic in that way. It's not just something to show off and, you know, show off fast you are, loud you are, whatever.
It's not just revving the engine.
No, it's got a purpose. It really does have a purpose, and it's getting everything, well, it probably is getting everything ready, and but it's not in any way like a launch from, you know, from the starting line.
Right.
It's not like that. It's not controlled. It is controlled, but it's not, they're not trying to do it with minimal or no tire slippage. They're trying for the opposite. They want maximum tire slippage at that point.
And let's also point out, this process is incredibly loud.
Yeah.
It's, I think I read on the NHRA's website, it's comparable to somebody bombing the racetrack or something.
Yeah, you know, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you saw that too?
Yeah, because you can feel, you know how they have kind of a pop, pop, pop sound when you hear it? And you're feeling the exhaust, really, because it just comes directly out of the cylinders. There's just straight pipes, really. You feel that. I've been near one when it starts up, and you feel it in your chest, you feel it in your clothes. It's like, you know, I guess music with heavy bass.
Yeah.
Only imagine it even stronger than that. I mean, if you were nearby it, it would hurt your eardrums. It would literally hurt. I mean, you'd probably lose your hearing quickly.
I imagine, so I read somewhere that the decibel levels it reach are past the threshold where your eardrums experience physical pain.
Yeah, yeah, they flex and they would hurt.
That's so weird.
Yeah, I know. I've never experienced noise like that before, but I've been near one with plugs in, and it's not so bad. I mean, it's loud, but I like that.
Why is this thing so loud?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, it's because it's a giant, giant engine, and we'll get into that in a second, too, here. I think the engines, they're all powered by a supercharged, fuel-injected 500 cubic inch engine that's kind of adapted from the Chrysler Hemi engine. So everybody uses this Chrysler Hemi engine, which is odd because, you know, you'll see cars that are Ford cars that are running a Hemi engine. You'll see General Motors cars that are running a Hemi engine. They're sponsored by that. But they all are based on this Hemi engine.
And that's because of the restrictions actually imposed on the building and construction.
Exactly. Yeah, it's very, very standardized. It's very formed, very sanctioned. You know, it's a sanctioned event, so it's very, very standardized for everybody. There's blueprint specifications you have to build your engine to in order to qualify for certain classes, and so they're adhering to that. The crazy thing about these cars, and here we start to go with the numbers here.
Yeah.
Horsepower is, I've seen numbers between 7 and 8,000 horsepower for these cars.
That is so, I mean, really?
Yeah.
7,000, 8,000?
8,000 is a number that I got from a website about the Army car. Tony Schumacher, who drives a U.S. Army car. That site's claiming 8,000. Now, I don't know if that's, you know, that's boasting a little bit or not, but most of the numbers that you'll see will claim 7,000 or something in between. But you're talking about 8,000 horsepower that you're sitting behind or in front of for a quarter-mile blast down the strip.
And how do they stay on the ground? You know, that's a good question.
Well, they stay on the ground with tremendous downforce that comes from that rear wing. And I think I had somewhere that rear wing provides something like is it 8,000?
I had a number there in that.
Yeah, it's 8,000 pounds, or between 4 and 8,000 pounds of downforce that rear wing develops when it's at top speed. So it's got the downforce. Now you got to keep the front end down, which is the hard part, but that's driver skill because these things could instantly flip over right at the starting line. They could just the front end could just flip up and that's it. So these guys are in complete control of it. They launch it perfectly in order to get to the quarter-mile mark in the least amount of time possible.
Oh, man, we completely forgot. I'm sorry. It's the quarter-mile mark. That's what, what they're racing.
Well, it's a quarter-mile race, and I guess this is backtracking considerably
just a bit,
at this point.
Just
but,
a bit.
It's a quarter-mile track. There are junior classes that go half of that, so eighth of a mile. And the weird thing about this is, now the lanes are, they're two lanes, they're about 30 feet wide, that's average, national average, I think, and the crazy thing about this is that they don't measure really in speed like you would think. They don't say, you know, this car goes 0 to 60 in this amount of time like we gauge a streetcar. That's because these things are going too darn fast. So they could do that, but what they do is, and there is a final speed, of course, but they measure in... let's see, 5 intervals. The cars are measured in distance at where they are at a certain point. So you know, for the overall race winner, you're looking for a lowest elapsed time. So that's just time from the start line to the finish line. That's your lapse time. And then from that, they gauge how the average speed.
Oh, I see, through the intervals.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we get the average speed, which we'll eventually get to. But they're measured at 60 feet, 330 feet, 660 feet, which is the eighth of a mile mark.
So that's a halfway mark.
That's a halfway point. Then 1,000 feet, and then again at the quarter mile mark, which is 1,320 feet.
Okay.
So there's 5 measurements that happen of time, but really the final one is the one that's the most critical.
And zoom. I bet that happens so quickly.
It happens extremely fast. In fact, that 60-foot mark comes up in something like 0.8 seconds. So, and it could be even faster, depends on how the car is running, but I'm going by Tony Schumacher's marks here on his website. 0 to 100 miles per hour in 0.8 seconds, which is really that's the 60-foot point in the run. So pick a point, this is unbelievable. If you look about 60 feet away from you right now, imagine being there in roughly half a second and traveling at 100 miles per hour.
You know, not to get off topic, remember when we were talking about teleportation earlier?
Yeah.
That's what this would feel like.
That's pretty darn close, isn't it?
Yeah. It's good enough for me.
Oh, yeah. That would be good enough for me, too. I mean, something at speed like that. In fact, you know what? We'll come back to that in just a second.
Okay.
I've got a comment from someone that I used to know, a racer, that kind of makes sense here. But then the 350-foot mark or the 330-foot mark can come up as fast as about 2.5 seconds or 2.2 seconds. So at that point, they're traveling about 200 miles per hour.
Jeez.
So you're talking, you know, 2.2 seconds, you're going double that speed. And then, of course, you know, at the end, I mean, we're talking about a full run, quarter mile, top speed of right around, 330 plus, 335, something like that is what these guys are doing now.
Wow.
For the quarter mile. The quarter mile time is right about it's a little under 4.5 seconds. So if you look down the road about a quarter of a mile and... try to imagine being there in 4.5 seconds.
4.5 seconds.
That's from a dead stop. So you can imagine what that feels like. That's going to be unbelievable.
That's the length of the race for the driver. That's
exactly
incredible. How do they?
You know, I don't know how a human can stand that type of force. Because I used to know a racer. His name was Bobby Martin. This is when I worked at Chrysler.
Okay.
And I went to Bobby Martin's site just recently and check out what he's doing. He drove the Cap Avenger, which is a Dodge Charger. It's a top alcohol funny car, and he has about 3,000 horsepower in his car. And again, it's a 500 cubic inch, it's a 526 cubic inch Hemi engine in that class. And this is the one that, you know, has the single piece body that we were talking about.
Yeah, that lifts up.
One time, and I just remember this comment from me, I said, well, what does that even feel like, you know, when you launch from the starting line? And he said, it's as if, and he said, I've never had this happen, of course, but he said, imagine if you were sitting on the road and you were at a dead stop and a semi-truck hit you going about 100 miles per hour, just flat on the back end of your car, about 100 miles per hour. That's about as close as I can get to describing what it must, you know, what it feels like when I let the clutch go.
Jeez.
So, the G-forces that are involved, because Tony Schumacher, again, from his site, mm-hmm. He's got a couple of G-forces listed.
I love to hear about the G-forces.
Oh, you do? Well,
yes.
Cool. Six G's are what they pull at the starting line.
Six times the gravity of Earth's surface.
Exactly. Yep, six G's are what they pull at the starting line. Not only that, when they pull the parachutes at the end, they deploy the chutes and then mm-hmm. hit the brakes. Now, they're going over 300 miles per hour, remember. Negative 6 Gs. So they pull just as many negative Gs when you hit the parachutes. Yeah, because you're going to decelerate extremely rapidly from about 335 or 300, because they coast slightly. They shut down the engines just as they cross the line. And then the chutes are deployed, and then the brakes are hit. So
I don't know, Scott. You know, now it sounds like it could be hell of a good time if we could actually get one of these.
I think it would be a blast. It's extremely dangerous, of course, but it sounds like an awful lot of fun. It really does. Now, I heard a long, long, long time ago, there was some rumor going around. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think it was Big Daddy Don Gartlitz. You've heard the name, probably.
I've heard the name.
Drag racing.
Yeah.
I heard that when he quit racing, he was actually losing his sight because of the negative Gs that he pulled when the chutes would deploy at the end, because you're raising your eyebrows at me.
Really?
And I don't know if it's true or not. I've never been able to just, you know, make sure that this is accurate or not.
Yeah.
But I had heard so many times that it was because, you know, the negative G forces that he would hit at the finish line mm-hmm. when he pulled the chutes, that his eyes were detaching from, you know, whatever's behind.
The optic nerve?
Exactly. Exactly.
Really?
And I can't verify that's true or not, but it sounds possible. If you do that, imagine doing that hundreds and hundreds of times, because I've been on just simple amusement park rides that go fast backwards.
It's like the ultimate repetitive work injury.
Did I say that right? Fast backwards?
Yes.
Yeah, and it feels like, you know, the type where it feels like your face is coming off?
Uh-huh.
That's the feeling. I mean, imagine far more severe than that.
Yeah.
I mean, way more severe. And you're doing that several times on a weekend, mm-hmm. and then you've got practice in between, and then you've got, you know, years of this, well, months, years, mm-hmm. decades of that. I could see where something physically would begin to happen to you from something like this.
I agree with you, but I still think I would like to try this out if possible. One of the things that is going to be a little bit of an obstacle, Scott, is the first thing we would do if we get a dragster is we would have to afford the fuel, because of course it's called Top Fuel.
Sure.
And that's because, and you know why this is. You want this one? You want me to take
it? No, go right ahead.
All right. The catch, if you know, we love drag cars here, but the catch is there are a few cons, you know, to owning a Top Fuel dragster. Mm-hmm. First off, turning is a no-no, you know.
That's right. Yeah, it's straight line only.
Yeah, we'll be able to hang out with people who live straight in a straight line.
Understood.
Yeah, but secondly, and this is a primary concern, we can't pull into a gas station and just fill it up with premium or diesel or anything.
What? I'm shocked.
Are you shocked?
Yeah, I'm shocked.
You look very shocked.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just
going to tell us why they call it Top Fuel. Right?
Yes, because okay. these vehicles use nitromethane instead of gasoline. And it's made of 90% methane, 10% methanol.
Okay.
And it also has some distinct advantages. Not so much advantages for us, unless we're actually racing. It doesn't burn as quickly as gas. So there's not enough time to burn up all the fuel between when the spark plug fires and when the valve opens, the exhaust valve.
So you couldn't just dump this in your streetcar?
No, you can't. It's specifically
engine.
For this.
Okay.
It is really the Top Fuel. And it's kind of, it's hard to explain, but by changing the fuel, it's sort of like we're hacking the engine and we can double or triple the engine's normal horsepower.
I see.
That's which is why it goes so high.
So that's why they get 8,000 horsepower from a 500 cubic inch engine, which, you know, Cadillacs had engines bigger than that in their day. I mean, back in the 60s, you know.
Right.
Or I don't know, you know, exactly what era, but they had huge engines. So, you know, and they weren't they weren't putting out 8,000 horsepower, of course.
No.
But that makes sense now. I understand. It's a more combustible fuel. Is that right? Is that the right way I'm thinking
Yeah,
of it,
you can get more power from each explosion.
Oh, there's more energy from each explosion. Okay, I got it. I know one other downside to this.
What is it?
Cost.
Oh,
you
man.
Know the cost?
No, go ahead. What is it?
This is a bummer. You know what? Before I tell you that, I'm going to tell you this. They use between 10 and 12 gallons of fuel for one run. So that includes the burnout where they back up and then they do the quarter-mile run. Between 10 and 12 gallons each time they run, okay?
So not the best fuel efficiency.
No, that's for a quarter mile, right?
Right.
Okay, so 10 to 12 gallons for a quarter mile. And, you know, I'm going to sweeten it just a little bit with this bit of info here. The fuel pump for an NHRA Top Fuel Dragster delivers 65 gallons of fuel per minute, which is equivalent to 8 bathroom showers running at the same time. And that's from NHRA.com. So that's
wow.
And all these little facts that I've got here that I've been sprinkling in are from NHRA. I just can't believe the and not only that, the PSI, the pounds per inch per square inch on the for the fuel pressure, fuel line pressure, is between 400 and 500 PSI on a Top Fuel Dragster. So that's 20 times greater than the pressure on passenger car fuel pumps. So these things are really sucking in the fuel, you know, the engines. Now, here's the bummer part that I mentioned.
All right, give me a second. Okay, go.
$16 per gallon. And that was, you know, just an approximation, and I don't know when that number comes from. So it's
$16 per gallon for the fuel.
Per gallon. And you're talking 10 to 12 per run for a Top Fuel Dragster. So, and you heard the burn rate on this thing. I mean, it's capable of burning, or the pump is capable of delivering 65 gallons per minute.
Yeah.
At 10 to, or right, rather 16 gallon, $16 per gallon. That gets expensive.
Yeah, there is a little, okay. All right. So if we ever had one of these, we would have to race for money and we would have to win because otherwise we wouldn't have gas.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So it's unbelievable. I mean, I guess the equivalent of that is, they say that, the equivalent is between 16 and 20 gallons per mile is what, you know, if you extrapolate out that quarter mile run into what it really would be for the actual race itself.
Yeah.
It burns about 16 to 20 gallons per mile. So you don't calculate it. you don't calculate it in,
in quarter mile.
Yeah.
Elmer you average Fudd. It out.
There's Elmer Fudd there for a moment.
That was pretty good,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
I think we should also, just point out to, let's see, was it Eric who indirectly asked us about how to get involved with racing?
Yeah, exactly.
We're answering some questions about the drag cars now, or the dragsters now, but we're not really going to touch on how to hop into the drag racing until, you know, a little later.
We'll do like what we did with the motorcycles. Mm-hmm. We kind of just touch on this. In fact, we just had a specific request for the Top Fuel Dragsters, and I'll be honest, this is kind of a hook that, you know, these are the interesting ones to talk about. There's a lot of interesting classes to talk about, don't get me wrong, but these are the big daddies on the track.
These things are monsters.
These are the 25-foot long monsters, and these are kind of the show dogs of the whole thing, and I like talking about them. I like talking about other types of racing as well, so other types of drag racing. And with 200 classes, I think is what it said, and I forget how many subcategories of that. And then, you know, we're just talking about a very, very narrow portion of this population of NHRA.
Nice population.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it's also one of the most extreme. And I know I've been making these driving without turning jokes for a little while over the length of this episode, but I'm doing that because I have a little bit of listener mail for you, Scott.
Great. I love it.
John writes in and he says, Scott and Ben, when I was in school, I was told that for the purposes of defense, there had to be a 1 mile stretch of straight road for every 5 miles. And he's talking about the Eisenhower Interstate System, right? Interesting thing, because, you know, we just did that episode and we talked about some of the fascinating trivia there. Okay, and Matt also writes in and says that when he was growing up, he was told that the Eisenhower Expressway, or I-55, had to have at least 1 mile of perfectly straight, unobstructed roadway for every 5 miles for the purpose of emergency aircraft landing. Have you heard about this, Scott?
I've heard about that, yeah.
So we had two people write in and ask us about this, and I thought it was interesting. Do you know?
Go ahead and lay it on me.
It's not true.
It's not true.
It's unfortunately not true. Yeah. For the purposes of building the interstate, it makes sense to have things straight if we can have them straight.
Yeah.
And let's see, Matt is a civil engineer, so he's looked at maps of the Eisenhower Expressway, mm-hmm. and he can confirm that it does have that ratio of a straight mile for every 5 miles.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that you could actually spot. I mean, I guess you could spot that if you had a great map.
Right.
It's a myth, though.
It's a myth.
Yeah, it is a myth. The idea is great that you know that's possible, and it's possible. I've seen an airplane on a highway, had a ditch median, but this is just like a little Cessna airplane,
right?
And it ran out of fuel, so it's possible that you could land a plane on a portion of highway that's maybe a rural part. Mm-hmm. There's that word again, rural part of part of the highway. But when you really look at it, I mean, even on those straight stretches, you see, signs that have been put up. You see a concrete median in the middle, fences. You see trees. Mm-hmm. It's not wide enough for the wings of a jetliner to land.
Sure, especially like a DC-10 or something.
Or like a big transport, a military transport plane, which is, I assume, what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. If they need to onload or offload military equipment, they could do that. I think there are places that could happen, but it was not designed that way. No.
According to, I checked out a couple of different sources. Snopes was one of them. There was a proposal for some time to build landing strips alongside the interstate, but not to actually use it, and it never happened. It's not designed that way. The best explanation, for why it's not designed this way, because it doesn't sound like a bad idea until you think in a crisis situation, one of the worst things you could do is close down the roads to land a plane, because you're going to have, we have thousands of airports. Do we have thousands?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Of course.
Somebody call me on that if
hundreds
I'm wrong.
Hundreds and hundreds of thousands. I don't know.
We have a lot.
Maybe a million.
We have enough that if we had the government taking over areas, they would probably just use the airports that are already
Yeah,
around.
Sure, just the local airports. Yeah. And if they don't have the length of runway needed, they could transfer them to the next closest one that does have that available. Now, I see a problem with the runway on the side of the road, and that would be maintenance.
Yeah,
because who would maintain that roadway? Because I mean, you and I know that if you leave a stretch of road alone, you're going to see weeds growing through the cracks, and there's wintertime maintenance. There's it's just a lot of factors that can go into this.
Big expense.
Yeah, and what's to stop the farmer that lives nearby from parking his tractor there?
Right.
Not that he's supposed to, but he may, and that would cause trouble, I would think, when you're trying to land a plane.
Yeah. So it's interesting and it's fascinating. Unfortunately, it's not much more than a good story, but it does sound reasonable.
But you know what? I had heard that the entire time I was growing up, and it wasn't until we were doing some research for that podcast that I learned that it was not true. We just didn't include it. We forgot to mention it.
And we're going to end on a mystery here, because with one last listener mail, Chris writes in and says that 10 years ago, his 7th grade teacher told him that each highway is required to have overpasses that are tall enough to accompany a semi-trailer truck hauling a nuclear missile. And so we're going to throw this out to you guys, and maybe you can get back to us and tell us if you think it's true, because I haven't really looked into this one yet, but I thought it was interesting. And of course, Scott, if somebody wants to send us an email, where do they send it?
HighSpeedStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the new High Speed Stuff blog, now on the HowStuffWorks homepage.